rolled over, and rested her forehead against his chest. "I thought I might never see you again," she whispered.
"Aye,"
he said softly, and his hand stroked her long hair and her back.
"Me too."
They were silent for a long moment, each listening to the other's breath. His came easier than it had, she thought, without the small catches. And then he finally said,
"Tell me."
She did, baldly, and with as little emotion as she could manage. She thought he might be emotional enough for both of them. He couldn't shout or curse because of the sleeping children. She could feel the rage in him. He was shaking with it, his fists clenched like solid knobs of bone.
"I'll kill him,"
he said, in a voice barely pitched above silence, and his eyes met hers, savage, and so dark that they seemed black in the dim light.
"It's okay," she said softly,
and sitting up, took both his hands in hers, lifting one and then the other to her lips.
"It's okay. We're all right, all of us. And we're here."
He looked away and took a deep breath, then looked back, his hands tightening on hers.
"Here,"
he repeated, his voice bleak, still hoarse with fury.
"In 1739, if I'd..."
"You had to," she said firmly, squeezing back hard. "Besides," she added, a little diffidently, "I sort of thought we wouldn't stay.
Unless you've taken a great liking to some of the denizens."
Expressions flickered across his face, from anger to rue to reluctant acceptance, and an even more reluctant humour as he got a grip of himself. He cleared his throat.
"Aye, well," he said dryly, "there's Hector McEwen, to be sure. But there are a good many other people, too. Gilles Duncan, for one."
A small jolt went through her at the name.
"Gilles Duncan? Well, yes. I suppose she would be here at this point, wouldn't she? Did you meet her?"
A truly extraordinary expression went over Roger's face at that question.
"I did,"
he said, avoiding her questioning glance. He turned and waved a hand at the surgery window that looked out onto the square.
"She lives just across the way."
"Really?" Brianna got to her feet, clutching a quilt to her bosom, forgot about her bad foot and stumbled. Roger leapt up and caught her by the arm.
"You don't want to meet her," he said with emphasis. "Sit down, aye? You're going to fall."
Brianna eyed him, but allowed him to ease her back down to their nest and to pull a quilt up over her shoulders. It was bloody cold in the surgery, now that the warmth of their efforts had faded. "All right," she said, and shook her hair down to cover her ears and neck. "Tell me why I don't want to meet Gilles Duncan." To her surprise, he flushed deeply, visible even in the shadows of the surgery. Roger had neither the skin nor the temperament to blush easily, but when he did describe, briefly but vividly, what had happened, or possibly not happened, with Buck, Dr. McEwen, and Gilles, she understood it.
"Holy moly," she said, with a glance over her shoulder at the window.
When Dr. McEwen said he'd find a bed with a friend?" Buck had gone off, saying that he'd take a bed at the Ordinary at the foot of the High Street and would see them in the morning. Presumably he'd meant it, but...
"She is married," Roger said tersely. "Presumably her husband would notice were she inviting strange men to spend the night."
"Oh, I don't know so much," she said, half teasing. "She's an herbalist, remember?
Mama does a good sleeping potion.
I imagine Gilles could, too." The colour washed up Roger's face again, and she knew, as clearly as if he'd said so, that he was envisioning Gilles Duncan doing something disgraceful with one or another of her lovers whilst lying beside her snoring husband.
"God,"
he said. "You, do remember what's going to happen to her poor husband, don't you?" Bree said delicately. The colour vanished instantly from Roger's face, and she knew he hadn't. "That's one of the reasons we can't stay here," she said gently but firmly. "There are too many things we know. And we don't know what trying to interfere might do, but it's a good bet that it's dangerous."
"Yes, but..." he began,
but broke off at the look on her face.
"Lallybroch, is that why you wouldn't go there?"
For he'd tried to take her down the hill to the house when he'd rescued her from the fort. She'd insisted that they must go to the village for help instead, even though it meant an awkward and painful 3-hour ride. She nodded and felt a small lump come into her throat. It stayed there as she told him about meeting Brian in the burying ground. "It's not just that I'm afraid what meeting them might do to... later," she said. And the lump dissolved into tears. "It's... oh, Roger, the look on his face when he saw me and thought I was Ellen. He's going to die in a year or two. That beautiful, sweet man. And there isn't anything we can do to stop it." She gulped and swiped at her eyes. He thinks he's seen his wife and son, that they're waiting for him. And the... oh, God, the joy on his face. I couldn't take that away from him. I just couldn't." He took her in his arms and rubbed her back gently as she sobbed.
"No, of course you couldn't," he whispered to her. "Dinna fashbree. You did right."
She sniffed and groped among the cloaks for something to blow her nose on, settling at last for a stained cloth from Dr. McEwen's table. It smelled of some pungent medicine, thank God, not blood.
"But there's Da, too," she said, taking a deep, tremulous breath. "What will happen to him? The scars on his back. I can't stand to think about that and us doing nothing, but we..."
"We can't," Roger agreed quietly. "We didn't. God only knows what I may have done already, finding Jerry and sending him wherever I did send him."
Taking the cloth, he dipped it in the water bucket and wiped her face, the cold of it soothing on her hot cheeks, though it made her shiver.
"Come, lie down," he said,
putting an arm round her shoulders.
"You need rest, Macrea. It's been a terrible day."
"No," she murmured, easing down and laying her head in the curve of his shoulder, feeling the strength and warmth of his body. "It's been a wonderful day. I have you back." Chapter 110. The Sounds That Make Up Silence. Roger felt her begin to relax, and quite suddenly she let go her stubborn hold on consciousness and fell asleep like someone breathing ether. He held her and listened to the tiny sounds that made up silence, the distant hiss of the peat fire in the bedroom, a cold wind rattling at the window, the rustling and breathing of the sleeping kids, the slow beating of Brianna's valiant heart.
"Thank you," he said silently to God.
He had expected to fall asleep himself at once. Tiredness covered him like a lead blanket. But the day was still with him, and he lay for some time, looking up into the dark. He was at peace, too tired to think coherently of anything. All the possibilities drifted round him in a slow, distant swirl, too far away to be troublesome. Where they might go, and how? What Buck might have said to Dougal Mackenzie? What Bree had brought in her bag, heavy as lead? Whether there would be porridge for breakfast? Mandy liked porridge. The thought of Mandy made him ease out of the quilts to check on the children, to reassure himself that they were really there. They were, and he stood by the bed for a long time, watching their faces in wordless gratitude, breathing the warm, childish smell of them, still tinged with a slight tang of goat. At last he turned, shivering, to make his way back to his warm wife and the beckoning bliss of sleep. But as he re-entered the surgery, he glanced through the window into the night outside. Cringsmuir slept, and mist lay in her streets, the cobbles beneath gleaming with wet in the half-light of a drowning moon. On the far side of the square, though, a light showed in the attic window of Arthur Duncan's house. And in the shadow of the square below, a small movement betrayed the presence of a man, waiting. Roger closed his eyes, cold rising from his bare feet up his body, seeing in his mind the sudden vision of a green-eyed woman, lazy in the arms of a fair-haired lover, and a look of surprise and then of horror on her face as the man vanished from her side. And an invisible blue glow rose in her womb. With his eyes tight shut, he put a hand on the icy window pane and said a prayer to be going on with. Part 7. Before I Go Hence. Chapter 111. A Distant Massacre. September the 5th, 1778. I folded the cloth into a tidy square and used the tongs to dip it in the steaming cauldron, then stood waving it gently to and fro until the compress should cool enough for me to wring it out and use it. Joni sighed, fidgeting on her stool. "Don't rub your eye," I said automatically, seeing her curled fist steal toward the large pink sty on her right eyelid. "Don't fret. It won't take long."
"Yes, it does take long," she said crossly. "It takes forever."
"Did it be giving your granny sauce?" Massali told her, pausing in her stride on the way from the kitchen to print shop, a cheese roll for Fergus in her hand. "Had you wished to be grateful?"
Joni groaned and writhed and stuck her tongue out after her departing mother, but whipped it back into her mouth again and looked rather shamefaced when she caught sight of my raised brow.
"I know," I said, with some sympathy.
Holding a warm compress on a sty for 10 minutes did feel like forever, particularly if you've been doing it 6 times a day for the last 2 days.
"Maybe you can think of something to pass the time. You could recite me the multiplication tables while I grind valerian root."
"Oh, Granny," she said, exasperated,
and I laughed. "Here you go," I said, handing her the warm poultice.
"Do you know any good songs?"
She exhaled moodily, small nostrils flaring.
"I wish Granda was here," she said. "He could tell me a story."
The note of comparative accusation was clear in her voice. "Spell Hordeolum for me, and I'll tell you the one about the water horse's wife," I suggested. That made her unaffected eye fly open with interest.
"What's a Hordeolum?"
"That's a scientific name for a sty."
"Oh."
She seemed unimpressed by this, but her forehead creased a little in concentration, and I could see her lips move as she sounded out the syllables. Both Joni and Felicite were good spellers. They'd been playing with discarded lead type since they were toddlers, and loved stumping each other with new words.
That was a thought. Maybe I could get her to spell unusual words for me during the compress treatments.
The sty was a big, nasty one. Her entire eyelid had been red and swollen in the beginning, the eye no more than a gleaming, resentful slit. Now the sty itself had shrunk to the size of a pea, and at least 3/4 of the eye was visible.
"H," she said, watching me to see if that was right, and I nodded. "O-R-D."
I nodded again and saw her lips move silently.
"Hordeolum,"
I repeated helpfully, and she nodded, more confident.
"E-O-L-U-M.
"Excellent," I said, beaming at her. "How about..." I cast about for another good one, long but strictly phonetic.
"Hepatitis." "What's that?"
"Viral infection of the liver. Do you know where your liver is?" I was looking through my medicine chest, but appeared to be out of aloe salve. I would ride over to Bartram's garden tomorrow, I thought, weather permitting. I was out of almost everything in the wake of the battle. The usual small twinge came at my side at thought of it, but I pushed it firmly away. It would fade, and so would the thoughts. Massali appeared suddenly in the kitchen door, as Joni was carefully spelling acanthocytosis, and I looked up from my grinding. She was holding a letter in her hand and looked worried. "Is it the Indian they call Joseph Brandt that young Ian kens?" she asked. "I expect he knows quite a few of them," I replied, setting down my pestle. "But I've heard him mention Joseph Brandt, yes. The man's Mohawk name starts with a T, I think, but that's as much as I feel sure of." "Why?" I felt a slight uneasiness at the name. Ian's Mohawk wife Emily had been living in a settlement in New York founded by Brandt. Ian had mentioned it very briefly when he'd gone up there to visit her last year. He hadn't said what the purpose of his visit was, and neither Jamie nor I had asked, but I assumed it to have had something to do with his fear that he couldn't sire children, as all his babies with Emily had either been stillborn or miscarried. He'd asked me about the matter, and I'd told him what I could, offering what reassurance I could that he might be able to have children with another woman. I offered up a quick prayer for Rachel's chances, then returned abruptly to what Massali was saying.
"They did what?"
"This gentleman," she tapped the letter, "says that Brandt and his men fell upon a wee place called Andrewstown. No, but 7 families living there." Her lips pressed tight, and she glanced at Joni, who was listening with her ears flapping. "They plundered and burnt the place," he says, "and Massa did a war with a number of the folk who lived there."
"What's that word, ma'am?" Joni asked brightly. "The one that means did a war with?"
"Massacred," I told her, saving her mother the embarrassment. "It means indiscriminate and brutal slaughter. Here." I handed her the fresh compress, which she applied without protest, frowning in thought.
"Is that different than just killing someone?"
"Well," I said judiciously, "it depends. You might kill someone by accident, for instance, and that wouldn't be a massacre, though it would certainly be lamentable. You might kill someone who was trying to kill you, and that would be self-defense."
"Rachel says you oughtn't do that,"
Joni observed, but merely for the sake of thoroughness.
"What about if you're with an army and have to kill the soldiers on the other side?"
Massali made a low Scottish noise of disapproval, but answered tersely, "If a man's gone to the army, then killing is his job," she said. "He does it mostly," she added fairly, with a raised brow to me, "to protect his own family and property. So that's more like self-defense, aye?" Joni glanced from her mother to me, still frowning.
"I ken what brutal is," she said. "That's being mean when you haven't got to. But what's indiscriminate?"
She sounded it out carefully, as though about to spell it.
"Without choosing," I said, lifting one shoulder in a shrug. "It means you do something without taking much notice who you do it to, and probably without much reason to do it to that particular person."
"Did Cousin Ian's Indian friends have nae reason for burning yon place and killing the folk, then?"
Massali and I exchanged a glance.
"We dinna ken that," Massali said. "But it's no a good thing, whatever he meant by it. Now you're done. Go along and find Felicite and start in filling up the wash tub."
She took the compress from Joni and shooed her out. She stood watching until Joni had gone out through the back door, then turned to me and handed me the letter. It was from a Mr. Johansson, apparently one of Fergus's regular correspondents, and the contents were as Massali had said, though adding a few gruesome details that she hadn't mentioned in Joni's hearing. It was fairly factual, with only the barest of 18th-century ornaments, and the more hair-raising, literally, I thought. Some of the Andrewstown residents had been scalped, by report. For that. Massali nodded as I looked up from the letter.
"Aye," she said. Fergus wants to publish the account, but Amnesa's sure he ought to, because of young Ian, Ken.
What's because of young Ian? Said a Scottish voice from the print shop doorway, and Jenny came through, a marketing basket over one arm. Her eyes went to the letter in my hand, and her sharp, dark brows rose.
Has he told you much about her? Massali asked, having explained the letter. The Indian lass he wed?
Jenny shook her head and began taking things out of her basket. Near what? See if he's telling Jamie to say he wouldn't forget us.
A shadow crossed her face at the memory, and I wondered for a moment how it must have been for her and Ian, receiving Jamie's account of the circumstances in which Ian had become a Mohawk. I knew the agony with which he'd written that letter, and doubted that the reading of it had been done with less. She laid down an apple and beckoned to me for the letter. Having read it through in silence, she looked at me.
Do you think he's got feelings for her still?
I think he does, I answered reluctantly. But nothing like his feelings for Rachel, surely.
I did recall him, though, standing with me in the twilight on the Demi-Lune battery at Fort Ticonderoga when he told me about his children and Emily, his wife.
He feels guilty about her, does he? Jenny asked shrewdly, watching my face.
I gave her a look but nodded. She compressed her lips, but then handed the letter back to Massali.
Well, we dinna ken whether his wife has anything to do with his brand or his doings. And it's no her that's been massacred. I'd say, let Fergus print it, but, and she glanced at me, show the letter to Jamie and have him talk to wee Ian about it. He'll listen.
Her expression lightened a little then, and a slight smile emerged.
He's got a good wife now. And I think Rachel will keep him to home.
Mail was delivered to the print shop at all hours of the day, and, not infrequently, the night, and by all manner of messengers. Philadelphia gloried in the best postal system in the colonies, this having been established by Benjamin Franklin only 3 years before. Post riders rode regularly between New York and Philadelphia, and over 30 other routes through the colonies. Given the nature of Fergus's business, and the nature of the times, though, almost as much mail arrived by older routes, passed along by travellers, merchants, Indians, and soldiers, and shoved under the door in the night watches, or handed to a member of the family in the street. It was exchanges of that sort, during the British occupation of the city, that had compelled me to marry John Gray, in order to avoid arrest for sedition and spying. John's own letter, though, arrived sedately in the pouch of a postal rider, properly stamped and sealed with a blob of yellow wax, imprinted with his signet in the shape of a smiling half-moon.
To Mrs. James Fraser, Fraser's Print Shop, Philadelphia, from Lord John Gray, Wilbury House, New York. My dear, I am with my brother and his regiment in New York, and am like to remain here for some time. That being so, I thought I would mention that the lease of my house on Chestnut Street will run until the end of the year. And, as the thought of it being left empty-handed to be vandalized or left to ruin distresses me, I conceive the notion of offering it to you once again. Not, I hasten to add, lest your intransigent husband be reading this, as a domicile, but rather as premises for a surgery. Acquainted as I am with your peculiar habit of attracting persons suffering from disease, deformity, or hideous injury, and being also well acquainted with the number of persons presently inhabiting the younger Mr. Fraser's printing establishment, I believe you may find your medical adventures more easily accommodated in Chestnut Street than between a printing press and a towering stack of sixpenny Bibles bound in buckram. As I do not expect you to spend your valuable time in domestic labour, I have arranged for Mrs. Fig and a servant of her choice to remain in my employment for so long as you require them, being paid through my bank. You will greatly oblige me, my dear, by accepting this proposition, as it will put my mind at ease regarding the property. and the thought of you at work, earnestly administering a clyster to General Arnold, will greatly enliven the tedium of my present condition. Your most obedient servant, John.
What are you smiling at, Mother Clare? Massali inquired, observing me with a letter in hand. She smiled, teasing. Has someone sent you a billy-do?
Oh, something of the sort, I said, folding it up.
You wouldn't know where Jamie is just now, would you? She closed one eye to assist thought, keeping the other on Henri Christian, who was industriously blacking his father's best boots, and a good deal of himself in the process.
He said he was going with young Ian to see a man about a horse, she said, and then to the docks.
The docks? I said in surprise. Did he say why?
She shook her head.
I could maybe guess, though.
That'll do, Henri. A year. The state of you. Go find one of your sisters and tell her to wash your hands for you, aye?
Henri looked at his hands as though astonished to find them completely black.
Oui, maman, he said,
and cheerfully wiping them on his breeches, scampered out into the kitchen, bellowing,
Félicité, come wash me,
at the top of his lungs.
Why? I asked, moving closer and lowering my voice slightly, for obviously she'd got rid of Henri Christian on the little pitcher's big ears principle.
He's been talking with Fergus about going with you when you go back to North Carolina, she said. If I had to guess, I'd say he's gone to find out what it might cost to move everything.
She made a sweeping gesture, encompassing everything from printing press to loft.
By ship?
Hmm, I said, as non-committally as possible, though my heart had leapt at both the thought of imminent departure for the ridge and the thought that Fergus and Massali might come with us.
Do you want to?
I asked cautiously, seeing the line between her brows. She was still a lovely woman, fair and fine-boned, but she was too thin, and the lines of strain sharpened her features.
She shook her head, but in indecision rather than negation.
I really dinna ken, she admitted. It's a good bit easier now with the British gone. But they're no so far away, are they? They could come back. And then what?
She glanced uneasily over her shoulder, though the print shop was empty for the moment. Fergus had had to leave home and live furtively on the outskirts of the city during the last months of the British occupation.
I opened my mouth to tell her that I doubted this. Hal Gray had told me, under the influence of ganja, that the new British strategy was to sever the southern colonies from the north and suppress the rebellion there, thus starving the north into submission. But I closed it without speaking. Best not to mention that until I found out whether Jamie had told Fergus.
Why didn't I bloody know what was going to happen? I asked myself in frustration, and not for the first time. Why hadn't I thought to brush up on American history when I had the chance?
Well, because I hadn't expected to end up in America, was the answer. Just went to show, I suppose. Pointless to spend too much time in planning, anyway, given the propensity of life to make sudden left-hand turns without warning.
It would be wonderful if you were to come, I said, as mildly as possible, adding craftily, so nice to have the children nearby.
Massali snorted, giving me a sideways glance.
Aye, she said dryly. Never think I didn't appreciate the value of a granny.
And when you leave, Granny Janet will go too.
Do you think so?
I hadn't thought of that.
But Jenny loves you and your children.
Fergus is as much a son to her as any of the boys she bore.
Well, that's maybe true, she admitted, with a brief smile that showed me the radiant 15-year-old who had married Fergus on a Caribbean beach 12 years before. But young Ian's her youngest, Ken, and she's had too little of him. Now he's wed, she'll want to be nearby to help with his bairns when they come. And you ken Rachel will go where Ian does, and Ian will go where Da does.
That was a shrewd assessment, I thought, and gave her a brief nod of agreement and respect. She sighed deeply, and sitting down in her nursing chair, took up the topmost item in the brimming mending basket the threaded needle still sticking up from the garment where she'd last put it down. I had no desire to abandon the conversation, and, pulling out a stool, sat down beside her and plucked one of Germaine's stockings out of the basket. The workbasket, with its housewife, thread balls, and darning egg, was set beside the mending, and I deftly threaded my own needle, feeling pleased that I could still do that without putting on my spectacles. "What about Fergus?" I asked bluntly, because, plainly, Fergus was the crux of the matter where Massali was concerned. "Aye, that's the rub," she said frankly. "I'd go, and happy. But you ken how it was for him when we stayed on the ridge." I did, and grimaced slightly, stretching the heel of the stocking over the darning egg. "It's been dangerous in the city this last year," she said, and swallowed at the memory. "Couldn't tell you how many times the soldiers came to arrest him. They broke up the shop, more than once, when they couldn't find him. And the loyalists would come and paint slogans on the front wall sometimes. But the danger didn't trouble him, so long as it didn't threaten me and the bairns. And sometimes, even if it does," I muttered. "And I don't mean just Fergus. Bloody men." Massali sniffed with amusement. "Aye, but the thing is, he is a man, no? He's got to feel he's worth something. He needs to be able to care for us, and that's a thing he can do, and do well, here. I can't see how he'd make a decent living in the mountains." "True," I admitted reluctantly. It was a hot day and stifling in the kitchen, with the cauldron simmering over the hearth. Flies or no flies, and there were an ungodly number of flies in Philadelphia, I got up to open the back door. It wasn't noticeably cooler outside, though at least the fire under the big wash tub hadn't yet been lit. The girls were still filling it, trudging to and fro from the well with their buckets. Henri Christian was nowhere in sight, but had presumably been scrubbed. A filthy black cloth lay crumpled on the doorstep. I stooped to pick it up, and saw a folded bit of paper lying on the ground beside the step. It had no direction on it, but looked purposeful, so I picked it up and took it back inside. "Still," Massali said, barely waiting for me to sit down, "I'm thinking that even if we canna go to the ridge, it might be as well if we were to go. There must be places in the south that could use a printer, even if they're none sae big as Philadelphia." "Well, there's Charleston," I said doubtfully, "and Savannah. They're just as hot and ghastly in the summer as Philadelphia is, but the winters are milder, I suppose." She shot me a brief look over the shift she was mending, then set it down on her lap as though having come to a decision. "It's no the weather that troubles me," she said quietly. And bending, she groped under the pile of shirts and stockings, emerging with a handful of grubby notes and frayed letters. Handling these gingerly, as though they carried some disease, she placed them on my knee. "Any printer in these days gets such things poked under his door," she said, watching my face as I read through the first few. "Especially if you take a stand. We didn't, for as long as we could. But after a time, you just can't stand in the middle of the road any longer." This was said with a simplicity and acceptance that brought tears to my eyes. The more so with the content of the anonymous notes, for they were all unsigned, and in a variety of hands, though some were plainly written by the same person, making it quite clear what the price of standing on the rebel side might be. "It was worse, maybe," she said, taking them back and stacking them tidily, "when the British were here. I thought it might stop when they left, but it didn't." "I don't imagine all the loyalists left with them," I said, taking a deep breath, in order to control myself. I felt as though I'd been punched in the stomach. "Only the richer ones," Massali said cynically. "The ones who thought they'd be dragged from their homes or beaten and robbed without the army to protect them. But it doesn't mean the poorer ones dinna have the same opinions." "Why do you keep these?" I asked, handing them back with two fingers, as though holding them with tongs. I think I'd throw them into the fire at once.
I did, at first, she said, tucking the handful of nastiness carefully back into the bottom of the basket. But I found I couldn't forget what they said, and the words would come back to me at night and stop me sleeping. She straightened, shrugged, and took up her needle again. I told Fergus, and he said the thing to do was to keep them and read them through several times a day, one after the other. Read them to each other. A brief, rueful smile touched her mouth. So we did, after the bairns were asleep. We'd sit by the fire and take turns reading them. And he'd make fun of them, criticising the grammar and the lack of poetry, comparing them one to another, and we'd rank them from best to worst. And then we'd put them away and go to sleep in each other's arms. Her hand rested gently on the mound of mending, as though it were Fergus's shoulder, and I smiled. Well, I said, and clearing my throat, produced the note I'd picked up on the steps. I have no idea whether this is another one for your collection, but I found it on the back step just now. She took it with a raised brow and looked it over, turning it to and fro. It's cleaner than most, she observed. A decent rag paper, too. It's maybe just a... Her voice died away as she opened it and began to read. I could see that the writing inside was brief. Within seconds, the blood drained from her face. Masali! I reached toward her, and she thrust the note into my hand and rose swiftly.
Ladybird, ladybird, the note read, fly away home. Your house is on fire, and your children are gone.
Henri Christian, Masali's voice was strong and urgent. Girls, where's your wee brother? Chapter 112. Daylight Haunting. I found Henri Christian in the first place I looked, down the street, playing with the two smallest Phillips girls. The Phillipses had 10 children, and even Henri Christian could blend into their household without causing much notice. Some parents kept their children from coming anywhere near Henri Christian, whether from fear that dwarfishness was catching, I supposed, or from the popular superstition that his appearance was the result of his mother having fornicated with the devil. I'd heard that one now and then, though everyone in the neighbourhood knew better than to say it anywhere in the hearing of Jamie, Fergus, Ian, or Germaine. The Phillipses were Jewish, though, and apparently felt some kinship with a person whose differences set him apart. Henri Christian was always welcome at their house. Their maid-of-all-work merely nodded when I asked whether one of the older children would walk home with him later, then went back to her washing. It was laundry day all over Philadelphia, and the humid atmosphere was aggravated by a score of steaming washtubs in the neighbourhood, all fuming with the reek of washing soda. I went back quickly to the print shop to tell Masali where Henri Christian was, and having relieved her fears, put on my wide-brimmed hat and announced my intent of going to buy some fish for supper. Masali and Jenny, armed respectively with a laundry fork and a large paddle for clothes stirring, gave me marked looks. Both of them knew exactly how much I disliked doing laundry, but neither said anything. I had, of course, been excused from housework while recuperating, and in all truth was still not up to the labour of hoiking hot, sodden clothes about. I could have managed hanging out the washing, perhaps, but soothed my conscience on grounds that, one, fish made an easy supper on laundry day, two, I needed to walk regularly in order to regain my strength, and three, I wanted to talk to Jamie, alone. The anonymous letter had upset me nearly as much as it had Masali. It wasn't like the other threats she had shown me. Those were all specifically political. And while some were aimed at Masali, for she had run the newspaper alone while Fergus was in hiding, they were of the run-of-the-mill rebel bitch variety. I'd heard such epithets, along with Tory whore, and their German and Yiddish equivalents, commonly in the rougher parts of Philadelphia. This was different. It had the whiff of a refined and intelligent malice, and I suddenly felt the presence of Jack Randall at my shoulder so strongly that I came to an abrupt halt and spun around. The street was busy, but there was no one behind me, no glimpse of a red coat anywhere, though there were Continental officers here and there, in blue and buff. "Bugger off, Captain," I said under my breath. Not quite far enough under. I got a wide-eyed look from a round little woman selling pretzels from a tray round her neck. She glanced over her shoulder to see to whom I was speaking, then turned back to me with a look of concern.
"You are all right, madam," she said, in a heavy German accent.
"Yes," I said, embarrassed. "Yes, quite all right. Thank you."
"Take this," she said kindly, handing me a pretzel. "I think you are hungry."
And waving away my fumbling attempt at payment, she went off down the street, wide hips rolling, waving a stick of pretzels stacked like quoits and shouting,
"Brezeln! Heizer Brezeln!"
Feeling suddenly dizzy, I leaned against the front of a building, closed my eyes, and bit into the pretzel. It was chewy, fresh, and rimed with salt, and I discovered that the woman had been right. I was hungry. Starved, in fact. The pretzel hit my stomach, and then my bloodstream, imparting an instant sense of stability and well-being, and the momentary panic I'd felt evaporated so quickly that I could almost believe it hadn't happened. Almost. It hadn't happened in some time. I swallowed the last bits of pretzel, and after checking my pulse, strong and steady, set off again toward the river. I walked slowly. It was midday, and any great exertion would leave me drenched with sweat, and, very likely, light-headed again. I ought to have brought my walking stick, but had recklessly decided to do without it. I hated feeling infirm. I hated feeling that even more. The sudden sense of threat, irrational fear, violation. Flashback, the military called it. Would call it, in my time. It hadn't happened to me since Saratoga, though, and I'd almost forgotten about it. Almost. Completely explainable, of course. I'd been shot, come close to dying, was still physically weak. The last time, I'd been in the dark, in the forest, near a battlefield, alone, lost, and surrounded by violent men. No wonder it had happened then. The situation was much too close to what it had been when I'd been abducted and assaulted. "Raped," I said out loud, firmly, to the extreme startlement of a pair of gentlemen passing by. I paid no attention to them. No point in trying to avoid either the word or the memory. It was over. I was safe. Before that, the first time I'd been overtaken by that sense of threat, it was at River Run, in the course of a party. But a party with a sense of imminent violence was palpable. On that occasion, Jamie had been nearby, thank God. He'd seen that I was spooked, literally, he assumed, and had given me a handful of salt with which to lay the ghost that haunted me. The Highlands always had a practical answer, whether the difficulty was keeping a fire smoured for the night, having your cow run dry, or being haunted. I touched the corner of my mouth with my tongue, found a stray salt crystal from the pretzel, and nearly laughed. I looked over my shoulder for the woman who'd given me succor, but she'd vanished. "Just as an angel should, I suppose," I murmured. "Thank you." There was probably a charm for it in the garlic, I reflected. There were dozens, probably hundreds. I knew only a few, mostly those concerned with health. They gave my Gaelic-speaking patients reassurance, but picked the one that seemed most suitable to the situation, and strode firmly along, my feet solid on the cobbles, chanting, "I trample on thee, thou seizure, as tramples whale on brine, thou seizure of back, thou seizure of body, thou foul wasting of chest."
and then I saw Jamie coming up from the docks, laughing at something Fergus was saying, and the world dropped back into place around me. Jamie took one look at me, took my arm, and steered me into a small coffee house around the corner on Locust Street. At this hour of the day it was all but deserted, and I attracted relatively little attention. Women did drink coffee, when any was to be had, but they mostly drank it at home, in company with friends or at small parties and salons. And while there were grander coffee houses in London and Edinburgh that women might now and then frequent, the Philadelphia coffee houses tended to be male preserves of business, gossip and politics.
"What have you been doing, Sassenach?"
Jamie inquired mildly, taking the tray of coffee cups and almond biscuits from the server.
"You look..."
He squinted at me, evidently searching for a term that would be accurate without causing me to pour scalding coffee on him.
"Somewhat indisposed,"
Fergus said, taking up the sugar tongs.
"Here, my lady."
Without asking, he dropped three large lumps of brown sugar into my cup.
"They say that drinking odd beverages will cool you," he added helpfully.
"Well, it does make you sweat more," I said, taking up my spoon. "But if the sweat doesn't evaporate, it certainly won't make you cooler." I estimated the ambient humidity at roughly 1,000%, but tipped a little of my sweetened coffee into the saucer and blew on it nonetheless. "As to what I've been doing, I was on my way to buy fish for supper." "And what have you gentlemen been doing?"
Sitting down had made me feel a good bit steadier, and being flanked by Jamie and Fergus made the odd sense of threat I'd experienced in the street fade a bit. But thought of the anonymous letter on the step raised the hairs on the back of my neck despite the heat. Jamie and Fergus glanced at each other, and Fergus raised one shoulder.
"Reckoning our assets," Jamie said, "and visiting warehouses and shipping captains."
"Really?" The thought made my heart lift immediately. These sounded like the first concrete steps toward going home. "Have we got any assets to speak of?"
Most of our available cash had gone to pay for horses, uniforms, weapons, food for Jamie's men, and other war-related expenses. Theoretically, Congress would reimburse these expenses, but given everything General Arnold had told me about Congress, I rather thought we oughtn't to hold our collective breath in anticipation.
"A bit,"
Jamie said, smiling at me. He knew very well what I was thinking.
"I found a buyer for the gelding. £4.
"That seems a good price," I said uncertainly. "But wouldn't we need the horse for travel?" Before he could answer, the door opened and Germaine came in, a bundle of broadsheets under one arm and a scowl on his face. The latter disappeared like the morning dew as he spotted us, though, and he came to hug me.
"Grand-mère, what are you doing here? Maman said you went to buy fish."
"Oh," I said, suddenly guilty at the thought of the laundry. "Yes, I am. I was just on my way."
"Would you like a bite, Germaine?"
I offered him the plate of almond biscuits, and his eyes lighted up.
"One,"
said Fergus firmly. Germaine rolled his eyes at me, but took a single biscuit, lifting it with two fingers in exaggerated delicacy.
"Papa,"
he said, consuming the biscuit in two swift bites,
"I think perhaps you should go home."
Both of Fergus's strongly marked black brows rose.
"Why?" "Because," Germaine said, licking sugar from the corner of his mouth and eyeing the remaining biscuits, "Granny Janet told Mr. Sorrel that if he didn't leave off pestering Maman, she would stab him with the laundry fork."
"She might do it too,"
he added, thoughtfully, dabbing a finger on the plate for crumbs. Fergus growled. It quite startled me, as I hadn't heard anything like that from him since he'd been a feral 8-year-old pickpocket in Paris.
"Who's Mr. Sorrel?"
Jamie asked in a deceptively mild tone of voice.
"A tavern owner who passes by the shop on his way to and from his work and stops to buy a newspaper and to ogle my wife,"
Fergus said tersely.
He pushed back his bench and rose.
"Excuse me, milady," he said, bowing to me. "Had I best come with you?"
Jamie asked, also pushing back from the table. Fergus shook his head, though, and put on his cocked hat.
"No, the man is a coward. One sight of me and he will be gone."
His very white teeth showed in a sudden smile.
"If your sister has not disposed of him already."
He went out, leaving the biscuits at the mercy of Germaine, who scooped them tidily into his pocket before going to the counter to deposit the new broadsheets, take away the much red and coffee-spotted ones from yesterday, and collect his money from the proprietress.
"While you were reckoning assets, did Fergus tell you how well he's doing with the printing business?" I asked, pitching my voice low enough as not to reach Germaine.
"He did."
Jamie passed a coffee cup under his nose and grimaced slightly. The beverage was nominally coffee. A few genuine beans had likely been included in the brew, but contained a high proportion of chicory and a few other ingredients. I picked a small fragment of charred acorn out of my saucer and added more sugar. The print shop was, in fact, very profitable, the more so now as Fergus's chief competitor, a loyalist, had left town with the departure of the British Army.
"There are a good many expenses, though," Jamie explained, "and some of those have increased since the Army left."
Paper and ink were more difficult to obtain, with the Army no longer protecting transport in and out of the city. And the increased danger of the public roads meant that fewer orders of printed books were shipped, and, when they were, must either be insured or risk loss.
"And then there's insurance on his premises, which is expensive," Jamie added.
He pinched his nose slightly, then drank his coffee in three large gulps.
"Marsali doesn't like paying that," he said, gasping a little, "but Fergus kent what happened to my place in Edinburgh. And he told me a few things that Marsali doesn't ken too."
"Such as?" I cast a wary eye at Germaine, but he was engaged in what was plainly a saucy conversation with a serving girl at the counter. The girl was 2 or 3 years older than Germaine, but clearly amused by him.
"Ugh, the odd threat from folk who dinna like something he's printed, or who have their noses put out of joint because he willna print something of theirs. Bits of sabotage, sometimes. His broadsheets stolen from coffee houses and taverns and scattered in the street. Though he said that's got better since Mr. Dunphy left town."
"Dunphy being the loyalist printer?"
"Aye." "Germaine," he called across the shop, "have ye other places to visit today? Because if so, ye'd best get to them before your news goes stale."
That made the few customers laugh, and Germaine's ears went somewhat pink. He gave his grandfather a measured look, but was wise enough not to say anything, and with a few last words to the counter girl, went out, slipping the small cake she'd given him into his pocket with a casual air.
"You don't suppose he's been picking pockets, do you?"
I asked, observing the skill with which this manoeuvre was accomplished. Fergus had taught Germaine a good many of his own techniques in that regard, not wanting the skills to be lost.
"God knows, but all the better if he leaves Philadelphia. He willna find so much scope for that particular talent in the mountains."
Jamie craned his neck to see out the window, watching Germaine go down the street, then sat back, shaking his head.
"The main thing Fergus hasna told Marsali, though, is about yon French popinjay Wainwright."
"What? The fashionable Percival?" I asked, mildly amused. "Is he still around?"
"Aye, he is. Persistent wee sodomite,"
he observed dispassionately.
"He wrote out a detailed account of what he claims is the story of Fergus's parents, with the conclusion that Fergus is the heir to some great estate in France. Fergus says if it had been a romantic novel, it would have been criticised as too implausible, and nae publisher would touch it."
He grinned at the thought, but then sobered.
"Still, Fergus says he hasna the slightest intent of having anything to do with the matter, as even if it were true, he doesna mean to be a pawn for someone else's interests. And if it's not true, still less."
"Hmm. I had taken to simply eating the sugar lumps by now, rather than mixing them into the problematical coffee, and crunched one between my back teeth. Why is he keeping that for Masali, though? She knows about Wainwright's earlier approaches, doesn't she? Jamie drummed his hand on the table in thought, and I watched in fascination. He had been accustomed for a great while to drumming the two stiff fingers of his right hand when thinking. The middle and ring finger, which had been badly broken, crudely reset, and frequently rebroken, owing to the clumsy way it had stuck out. But I had finally amputated the ruined ring finger after he'd had half of it sliced off by a cavalry sabre during the First Battle of Saratoga. He still drummed his hand, though, as if the finger were still there, though now only the middle finger struck the tabletop.
"She does," he said slowly.
Fergus said that there began to be that odd wee bit of something in Wainwright's importunities. Not quite a threat, but just things like an observation that, of course, since Fergus is the heir to the Beauchamp estate, if he is in fact, then Germain would inherit the title and land after him.
I frowned. I can see that being offered as an inducement, but why is it a threat? He gave me a level look over the coffee debris.
If Germain would inherit this estate, Wainwright's principals dinna really need Fergus now, do they?
Jesus H. Really? I said. You, or rather Fergus, thinks Wainwright and company might kill him and then use Germain to get hold of this property or whatever it is they have in mind?
Jamie gave the ghost of a shrug.
Fergus hasn't lived as long as he has without having a sense of when someone means him harm. And if he thinks there's summat amiss wi' this Wainwright, I'm inclined to believe him.
Besides, he added fairly,
if it makes him more willing to leave Philadelphia and come south with us, I'm no going to persuade him that he's wrong.
Well, there's that.
I looked dubiously at the dregs of my coffee and decided against it. Speaking of Germain, though, or rather the children in general, that's actually why I was looking for you. And in a few words, I described the ladybird note and its effect on Masali. Jamie's thick auburn brows drew together, and his face took on a look that his enemies would have recognized. I had last seen it in the light of dawn on a North Carolina mountainside, when he had escorted me through woods and meadows, from one cold body to the next, to show me that the men who had hurt me were dead, to reassure me that they could not touch me. That was what made me, indisposed in the street, I said, rather apologetically. It just seemed so evil. But a sort of delicate evil, if you know what I mean. It rather gave me a turn. The dead had their own means of making you remember them, but I felt nothing at the memory of his vengeance beyond a remote sense of relief, and an even remoter sense of awe at the supernatural beauty of carnage in such a setting.
"I do know," he said softly, and tapped his missing finger on the table. "And I should like to see that note."
"Why?"
"To see whether the handwriting looks like that in Percy Wainwright's letters, Sassenach," he said, pushing back from the table and handing me my hat. "Are you ready?"
Chapter 113.
Thanks for all the fish.
I had bought a striped bass nearly as long as my arm, along with a mess of crayfish and a gunny sack of oysters from the estuary, and the kitchen smelled delightfully of fresh bread and fish stew. This was a good thing, as stew can always be stretched, and Ian and Rachel, with Rollo in tow, had drifted into the print shop just before supper, so visibly in the throes of wedded bliss that it made one smile, and occasionally blush, to look at them. Jenny did smile, and I saw her thin shoulders relax a little, seeing Ian's radiant face. I gave the stew a quick stir, and came over to stand behind her as she sat by the fire, laying my hands on those shoulders and kneading them gently. I knew bloody well what a day's laundry felt like in the muscles. She heaved a long, blissful sigh and bent her head to allow me to get my thumbs on her neck.
"Do you think our wee Quaker lass is wee child yet?" she murmured to me.
Rachel was across the room, chatting with the younger children, and very easy with them, though her eyes kept turning to Ian, who was looking at something Fergus had taken out of a drawer in the sideboard.
"They've been married barely a month," I whispered back, though I looked carefully at Rachel.
"Doesn't it take that long?" Jenny said, "and plainly the lad kens his job. Look at her."
Her shoulders quivered slightly with a suppressed laugh.
"A fine thing for a mother to be thinking about her son," I said under my breath,
though I could neither keep the amusement out of my own voice nor say she was wrong. Rachel glowed in the magic light of mingled dusk and half-fire, and her eyes rested on the lines of Ian's back, even as she admired Felicite's new rag doll.
"He takes after his father," Jenny said, and made a little hmm in her throat,
still amused, but with a faint tinge of longing. My own eyes went to Jamie, who had come to join Fergus and Ian by the sideboard. Still here, thank God. Tall and graceful, the soft light making shadows in the folds of his shirt as he moved, a fugitive gleam from the long, straight bridge of his nose, the auburn wave of his hair. Still mine. Thank God.
"Come cart the bread, Johnny," Massali called. "Henri Christian, stop playing with that dog and fetch the butter, aye? And Felicite, put your head outside and call Germaine."
The distant sound of boys' voices came from the street, shouts punctuated by the occasional thud of a ball against the front wall of the shop.
"And tell those wee heathens," I said, "if they break a window pane, their fathers will hear about it."
A brief outbreak of domestic chaos ended with all the adults seated on the benches at table, and the children in their own huddle by the hearth with their wooden bowls and spoons. Despite the heat of the evening, the fragrant steam of onions, milk, seafood, and fresh bread enveloped the table in a brief enchantment of anticipation. The men sat down last, their murmured talk stopping well short of the table, and I gave Jamie a brief questioning look. He touched my shoulder as he sat down beside me, saying,
"Aye, later,"
under his breath, and nodded at the hearth.
"Par devant les enfants, then."
Fergus cleared his throat, a small sound, but the children instantly stopped talking. He smiled at them, and their heads bowed over earnestly clasped hands.
"Bless us, O Lord," he said in French, "and these thy gifts, which we are about to receive from thy bounty, through Christ our Lord."
"Amen,"
everyone murmured, and talk washed over the room like the tide coming in.
"Are you bound back to the army soon, Ian?"
Massali asked, tucking a damp lock of blonde hair back into her cap.
"Aye," he replied, "but not Washington's army. No yet, anyway."
Jamie leaned across me to raise a brow at him.
"You've turned your coat, then," he said, "or just decided the British pay better?"
There was a wry edge to this. He'd not seen a penny of pay, and told me, frankly, that he didn't expect to. Congress wasn't swift about paying anyone, and a temporary general who'd resigned his commission was likely at the bottom of their list. Ian closed his eyes in momentary bliss, chewing an oyster, then swallowed and opened them, wiping a dribble of milk from his chin.
"No," he said equably. "I'm taking Dottie up to New York to see her da and Lord John."
That stopped all adult conversation dead, though the children continued to chatter by the hearth. I saw Jenny dart her eyes at Rachel, who looked composed, though considerably less blissful than she had before.